We are joined here live in the KODX studios by Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
A stellar week. Kind of nice that things have slowed down a little bit locally with the election. We're just going to be doing kind of a wrap-up of
There's still votes trickling in. There were a few more that were released yesterday. The big movement, of course, was that on Tuesday, Shama Sawant clinched her re-election. She was up by 1,500 votes with about 1,400 to count in District 3. And the headlines in places like the Seattle Times were palpable in their disappointment. It's like, Sawant is apparent victor. Well, if Egan O'Ryan can generate more than 1,500 votes with 1,400 to count, then he has a chance, which is to say he had no chance and she was the victor, period. And O'Ryan himself conceded on Wednesday. So,
yeah, I watched his concession speech and I have to say he did his best to try to make it look like he had a grassroots campaign, but no.
No. No.
Yeah.
And we'll, I'll talk
and
about
his,
that.
And his
a
volunteers
little
later. Were all there.
Yeah. Behind the camera, there are probably three of them.
Yep, exactly. So that that was the movement. The other thing that moved significantly in the council races is that Sawant was not the closest race. The closest race is in District 4, where Sean Scott has pulled within 1,387 votes of Alex Peterson, but there simply aren't that many votes left to count. So Peterson is in, and Sean Scott was gaining steadily from election night, but just had not enough votes left there to count for him to catch up.
And that was interesting because I was looking at the article in The Stranger on the per-vote candidate spending in the election. And I just want to, if you want to find that article.
This is rich.
It's a great article. The title is This Year's Election Spending Broke Per-Vote Spending Records by a Lot. And the author was Lester Black. It gives an analysis of both the spending by the candidates themselves and by the independent PACs, like the Chamber of Commerce's PAC, the Civic Alliance for a Sound Economy, or CASE. He lists the per-vote totals with Heidi Wills, Egan O'Ryan, and Jim Pugel at the top, all of them losers in their districts. Heidi Wills had $58.95 that she and the PAC spent per vote in her district. She managed to spend almost four times what her challenger, Dan Strauss, who actually won the election, spent. He spent $15.23 per vote. That, I think, is an astounding defeat right there. And he defeated her with a big margin, not a small margin.
It was relatively close on election night and has steadily widened since then.
Yeah.
And I would think that's what you want in a city council person, that they're really, you know, looking at good economics.
You know, cost-effective?
Saving people's money. Cost-effectiveness on Strauss's.
What you want on city council is somebody who's a tool of big business who doesn't know how to solve problems except by throwing huge amounts of money at them.
Yeah. Now, the second person on that list, Egan O'Ryan, as I said, keeps trying to make his campaign look like it was a grassroots one. He spent $50.11 per vote. Exactly double what Shama Sawant spent. She spent $25.04 per vote. And, of course, Sawant beat him, nevertheless. Jim Pugel and Andrew Lewis were the next highest spenders on the list, and they were both the District 7 candidates. Lewis had a lot of PAC money from labor unions. Pugel spent $49.80 per vote, and for Lewis, the total was $40.72 per vote. So a little bit closer there. But again, Lewis was outspent by Pugel, yet Lewis won the election. The fifth biggest spender on the list was Mark Solomon in District 2 at $40.51 per vote. That's 2.7 times more than neighborhood activist Tammy Morales spent. She spent just $15.09 per vote to just absolutely trounce him.
And yet she somehow got 60% of the vote.
Yes,
figure.
She did. And I think that was the widest margin of the night in the city council district races.
That's correct.
Sixth on the list was Phil Tavel, who spent $36.27 per vote, more than double what Lisa Herbold spent at $17.02 per vote, to just get within striking distance of Herbold, but not anywhere near to beating her.
And Herbold was badly outspent in her initial race in 2015 as well.
Yeah.
And she was relatively confident going into this year that she could win despite being badly outspent. And she did, and she was.
And she did, and she did a good job. Now, Alex Peterson, as you mentioned, he spent $28.98 per vote, and that's almost double what Sean Scott spent at $14.56 per vote. And that, I should point out, that's the lowest amount spent by a progressive candidate in this year's election, Sean Scott. So maybe if he'd been able to raise a little more money and get a few more volunteers in there, he might have made it over the top.
Yeah, he did have a ton of volunteers.
He did have a lot of volunteers, yeah. Now, the District 5 race had the two lowest spenders on the list. Deborah Juarez spent just $10.97 per vote to cruise to re-election against her right-wing NIMBY opponent, Ann Davison Sattler, who spent just $4.93 per vote. So that's the race where the re-election was going to be really easy for Deborah Juarez, and so the money didn't flow there. Black points out that the average spent was $28.93 per vote in the district elections. All of the progressive candidates except Andrew Lewis spent less than that amount, and all of the chamber-backed candidates except Deborah Juarez spent more than that amount.
I'm sensing a theme here.
Yes. Black goes on to point out that the previous record was set in city council elections was set by Shannon Braddock in 2015. That was Lisa Herbold's challenger. Braddock spent just over $30 per vote to lose to Lisa Herbold in District 1 by a narrow margin.
And there were, what, six candidates, I believe, that spent more than that this time?
Yeah. The most expensive campaign in city history was Jenny Durkin's 2017 mayoral race, which spent $1.9 million. But because that was citywide, the per vote total was just $15.45. This year, Heidi Wills' total election spending was $1.08 million, and Egan O'Ryan wasted a cool $1 million on his campaign. And that's much closer to what we're used to seeing in mayoral races rather than in city council races. Ed Murray, for example, spent $1.09 million, just a touch more than Heidi Wills on his election in 2013. Now, in terms of total campaign spending instead of per vote totals, the previous city council record is Tim Burgess's 2015 citywide campaign, which spent $646,000. So that shows you where Wills and O'Ryan kind of fall in terms of city council campaigns.
And specifically the Chamber of Commerce's attempt to buy city council,
yeah,
because that's where a lot of that money came from.
Well,
this was not O'Ryan's going out and raising money from the grassroots.
Yeah, and it didn't all just come from the Chamber of Commerce. Tim Burgess, who was the previous record holder for city council campaign spending, he formed his own PAC this year, People for Seattle, which I call Rich People for Seattle, which spent about $666,000 on those chamber-backed candidates. So there were other
Moms for Seattle did some last-minute spending.
Yeah, mm-hmm, and so forth.
You know, you'd mentioned Sean Scott, and if he just had more spending on his campaign, he mm-hmm. very well could have closed that gap and won. Shortly after the election, I've never met him, but Riel Johnson, who posts on Twitter and is a local activist, pointed out that the spending by the progressive PACs mm-hmm. was very white. It didn't really go hard. There was hardly any spending on the people of color who were running. And it was all
point.
To white candidates primarily, with the exception of spending money against one of the police.
Mark Solomon.
Yeah, Mark Solomon, spending money against him.
For Tammy Morales.
But had they taken
they're
a fraction.
Both people of color.
Had they taken his contention was if they'd, it was a wider contention than this, but if they had spent significantly more or even a reasonable amount on Sean Scott, that race could have been completely different than what it is now.
I think it points to some, because, for example, all of the labor money that went behind Lewis in District 7, some of that could have flowed to Sean Scott. But I think there's a big anti-socialist bent among a lot of labor unions and a lot of progressive activists. The word socialism makes them nervous.
And Shama Sawant in particular got almost no PAC support. She was the one candidate who won basically on her own. And
And it's kind of interesting because the history of the labor movement is intertwined with the early history of socialist movements in the past century. So it seems kind of strange now, although not strange when you also look at the history of the labor movement in the later half of the 20th century, the sort of anti-red baiting after the McCarthy era. And trying to purge their ranks of socialists, that they would be nervous about that now, but I just don't.
Well, and issues they've had with people of color in the past, too.
Mm-hmm. I mean, well, yeah. Racism.
Two of the big unions who spent a lot of money on PACs were SAIU and here, the hotel workers. So those two unions are both heavily people of color.
Yeah. So I'm not sure that that's necessarily.
No, I think it has more. Sawant is kind of a special case. But Sean Scott in particular, and also Tammy Morales for that matter, those races were not particularly close in the primary. Scott did not do particularly well. He split the votes with another progressive candidate, most of whose votes he picked up clearly, and he made some more ground between then and the general election. But between that and Mark Solomon versus Tammy Morales, and Morales comfortably won 50% in a 7 or 8-person field. PACs are going to go where they think the money is going to do the most good. And if they don't think those races are going to be competitive, they're not going to spend money there. And that has nothing to do with ethnicity.
Yeah, and it may also be, too, that some of the labor PACs looked at Alex Peterson and were fine with him as well.
Yeah.
So that might also be an issue here, too.
And Matt Watson also pointed out the other thing to look at with the PACs, in addition to their spending, is the makeup of their leadership and how many people of color are included in that. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that's going to affect their
almost
decision.
None.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Things to consider for the next
yes,
time around.
The economic elites in this city, whether they're labor or big business, are all still very much white.
Yeah. Now, I also want to point out, too, a separate article by David Croman at Crosscut this week looked at where all this year's PAC money was spent. Mostly it was spent on $1 million in paid canvassers and another $1 million in printed mailers and flyers. About $800,000 was spent on television ads, $500,000 on digital advertising, $400,000 on opinion polling, and $300,000 on political consultants. He theorizes that most of this money, especially the $1.8 million spent on mailers and TV ads, was largely wasted for district races. But I would argue that the additional $1 million spent on paid canvassers was probably also wasted on those candidates that didn't have a lot of volunteers. Volunteers, I think, are much more motivated. They're more authentic, certainly, when they're talking to people, and they're more knowledgeable in general about their candidates and the issues, I think, which makes them much, much more effective than paid drudges.
I was talking last week to somebody high up in the Sawant campaign mm-hmm. who was relaying a story. Of course, they had over 1,000 volunteers mm-hmm. and heavily canvassed parts of District 3, the parts that they thought would yield more votes for them. They had a very sophisticated system for rating every voter for where they might stand. But he was telling a story that one of their canvassers went out and ran into one of the Orion canvassers and basically talked the Orion canvasser into voting for Sawant.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they're not very committed.
Yeah, no, and not very knowledgeable about the issues and what's at stake compared to volunteers who are willing to get up, go out, spend their free time to work on a candidate's campaign. And I think that makes a big difference. So I thought that was kind of interesting that Croman had taken a look at, okay, where did the money flow to? How was it spent? And is it effective to run TV ads, in the Seattle area for district city council races when, how are you going to tell who's going to be watching when,
Unless they're very specifically targeted cable shows, you're looking at buying ads on the entire market, which mm-hmm. probably maybe one out of every 15 voters is going to be in that district, as opposed to either being in the suburbs or being elsewhere in the city.
Yeah, and then the question of flyers and mailers, too. It's like so many people barely look at their mail anymore. Most of it goes in the trash. Does sending them a flyer every day for your candidate really make a difference?
Yeah.
And a lot of that money also, as Croman pointed out, went out of state. you know,
went to out-of-state
companies.
At least
with the canvassers, we assume that it came back in-state to pay these people.
Well,
Of them came in from out of town.
Yeah, the canvasser, the company that...
The political consultants were largely out of state.
Yeah, the company that they paid most of the money to for canvassing was based down in California. So that money flowed down to California, and then it was...
Got laundered.
Yes, since California has a stronger currency than the United States.
Got spent on people who maybe live in Seattle but likely don't. So yeah.
Or they live in the Bay Area and were offered an exciting chance to take a vacation in Seattle for a couple weeks.
Yeah. Check out Seattle and see if they might want to move here where the rent's slightly cheaper. Just slightly.
All right. So tangential to that, some updates on a couple initiatives.
I also want to say too, on the city council, Lorena Gonzalez has pledged to move forward on her legislation to limit PAC money in Seattle elections after the budget negotiations are completed, which the city council tries to do by Thanksgiving.
How is that constitutional with Citizens United?
Well, we'll see. That legislation, I just want to point out, would limit the amount that individuals and businesses could contribute to a PAC to $5,000 in any election cycle within the city of Seattle. And that would eliminate the ability of companies like Amazon to write $1 million checks in the last few days of an election like they did this year. However, as Jav pointed out, there are some legal hurdles here. And that's the question. Gonzalez herself is an attorney, so I'm sure she's trying to work with some folks in the city attorney's office to figure out how to craft this thing in a way that would allow it to withstand a legal challenge.
Up against Citizens United.
Certainly the
city council has passed things without knowing whether they're constitutional in the past, like the income tax.
Well, or they passed things that they knew were not constitutional, like the income tax. Like the capital gains tax, but that they've counted on taking through the legal process to the state Supreme Court, where they hope the state Supreme Court will overturn it.
Yes, and that's...
Will overturn the ban.
Right, yeah. And that's where we are now on the city income tax.
Yeah, and the city income tax has been referred now to the state Supreme Court.
Yes.
And that's the very next step in the process for that. And a couple of things this week.
A couple of things this week.
Now, a progressive PAC, the Civic Alliance for a Progressive Economy, commissioned a post-election survey on Seattle voters' attitudes towards specific policy proposals. The survey found that a 58% majority of voters want the Seattle City Council and mayor to focus on building an economy that works for everyone versus 30% who would rather see them focus on reducing taxes and regulations on businesses and entrepreneurs. They also found that a 75% majority, that's 3 out of 4 people, supports raising local taxes on big businesses and the wealthy versus only 15% who oppose that.
You may remember that the city council repealed the head tax because they were afraid that it was going to go to a referendum.
Yeah, that voters would vote it down. But in fact, 3/4 of Seattle residents think it's a good idea. Now, a majority of 52% of voters also feels that Amazon and big businesses have too much influence on Seattle politics, with only 31% thinking that they have about the right amount.
I would love to see a comparison of that number with the same question asked 4 months ago.
Yeah. Now, interestingly, the survey asks if the respondents have a favorable or unfavorable view of Amazon to, I guess, weed out bias. The favorable percentage is 34% versus an unfavorable percentage of 39%. But there's a plus or minus margin of error of almost 5% in the survey. So I think we can conclude that the electorate is split pretty evenly between loving and hating Amazon.
And this is a company that nationwide consistently tops favorability polls.
Yeah. And that means that here in Seattle, there's a significant number of people who like Amazon as a company and like what they do, but who still think that they should pay more tax and butt out of our elections. I think that's pretty important.
And tangential to that, this week I saw the Seattle Times had an article about Jeff Bezos exploring purchasing the Seahawks, which would, I think, sway a lot of people to look upon him more favorably.
More favorably, yeah. I think that's definitely a move to try to win public favor there now.
Because he really doesn't have anything better to do with that $1 billion except make more money.
Or, you know, send people to Mars. Now, The city of Seattle, King
Send rich people to Mars,
yeah.
Which I'm all for.
Yeah, as long as they leave their assets behind.
Exactly.
Now, the city of Seattle.
Think of it as a rapture for the wealthy.
Yeah. Now, the city of Seattle, King County, Port of Seattle, Washington State Transit Association, the Association of Washington Cities and others have filed a lawsuit against Tim Eyman's $30 car tab initiative, 976.
And there will be more coming, I'm sure.
Yeah. They cite a number of grounds. Well, they filed two lawsuits, actually. In the first one, they cited a number of grounds, including that the initiative violates the state constitution by being about more than one subject, that the title and description were poorly written and didn't convey what the initiative would actually do, and that it seeks to nullify local election results. For example, it would nullify the 110 transportation benefit districts in Washington municipalities that have levied vehicle license tab taxes with voter approval. This lawsuit, however, doesn't these two lawsuits, however, don't include Sound Transit, which is likely to file its own separate lawsuit.
Yes.
Now, the plaintiffs filed the second lawsuit requesting an immediate injunction to prevent I-976 from taking effect on December 5th of this year, as it would otherwise. I-976, as we talked about last week, would cut approximately $4 billion in transportation spending by both the state and by local municipalities in Washington state over the next 6 years. Most of that is funding for transit and for basic road maintenance.
Yeah, and it would also take away Sound Transit's ability to raise money directly from voters in the area which it serves, because they would lose their taxing authority under that initiative. And that's really the crux of the two different subjects.
Yeah.
Sound, run afoul of.
Sound Transit has already borrowed money by issuing bonds based on revenue that they've been able to collect from the vehicle license tax. And their argument would be the voters can't pass an initiative or a package to collect taxes, to borrow money and then use tax revenue to pay off those bonds, and then turn around and say, well, we're not going to tax ourselves and we're not going to pay that debt. So that would be the crux, I think, of the Sound Transit lawsuit once once they file it.
Jeff,
and we should also mention in terms of statewide initiatives, that Referendum 88, as we expected last week, with King County's votes mostly counted, has the gap has been widened there. Out of about 2 million votes statewide, it's now trailing by about 20,000. So it's going to go down, but it's extremely close.
That was so close. Yeah.
Again, demonstrating the importance of getting out to vote.
Yep.
You know, had more people in King County voted.
Or Amazon spending its money more wisely.
Yeah, there you go, as you stated last week. All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right.
Let's move on.
Well, the city council was busy
working on the budget.
Week.
Yeah. As usual, this week the city council members submitted their proposed changes to Sally Bagshaw's balanced budget proposal. All the changes submitted needed to balance within themselves. If they proposed an increase in funding for one program, then they also needed to propose a cut somewhere else in the budget. Most of the money changes were proposed, were five proposals made by Shama Sawant, although there were some additional ones. I just want to list the ones that Sawant is trying to get Bagshaw to acknowledge and at least work on. Number one is to cut $522,000 in funding from the Seattle Police Department's $1.6 million program for recruitment and retention to pay instead for youth diversion programs run by groups like Youth Consortium, Creative Justice, the Rainier Beach Action Coalition, and others.
Yeah, all of which are great groups.
They're good groups, yeah, and they do very important work. She's also proposed cutting $8,395,000, the entire budget for the navigation team, and $200,000 for that's set aside for dismantling and or relocating the North Lake Tiny Home Village, and to spend that money instead on building 14 new tiny home villages, which have a better record of finding permanent housing for their residents than enhanced shelters. Currently, the budget that Bagshaw has proposed contains money to build only one new tiny home shelter.
Yes, and the city claims that its homelessness policies are data-driven, but it's very cherry-picked data.
Yeah.
They tend not to pay much attention to the more cost-effective groups.
Yeah. Now, the North Lake Tiny Home Village is currently self-governed. And they have been resisting efforts by the city to take over governance through with the assistance of Lehigh, and they've locked the city and Lehigh out, which is why they're being targeted now by the mayor and now through Bagshaw's budget for dismantlement and or relocation.
Yes, that's also the case of the Othello tiny home village.
Yeah. Now, it also would her proposal would also impose a proviso that no funds may be spent by the Human Services Department, Seattle Parks and Recreation, and the Department of Financial and Administration in 2020 to erect fencing to prevent unauthorized encampments. That's also part of that proposal. Now, number three on her list was to cut an additional $186,300 from the Seattle Police Department's recruitment and retention programs to pay for legal representation for non-intimate partner sexual violence survivors, including protecting their privacy and rights. This is geared, I think, primarily towards women who work in the sex trade, I think, given that the Seattle Police Department is now criminalizing prostitution again. After having criminalized pimping and the Johns, they gave the women a pass, but now they're arresting prostitutes.
Now they're giving the men a pass.
They started that again in July.
Yeah. Number four on Sawant's list is cutting $600,000 from the Seattle Police Department's $814,000 fund for hiring bonuses, and to use that money to fund renter organizing and outreach programs. $100,000 would be used for LGBTQ seniors. $107,000 would go towards Know Your Rights forums, such as those run by B Seattle. $200,000 would go to the Tenants Union of Washington or other groups to fund building-based tenant associations. And $200,000 would go to direct outreach to renters. Number five on her list is to cut $470,000 of money carrying forward from last year's budget in the Seattle Department of Transportation for outreach and public engagement on congestion pricing efforts, money that wasn't spent last year, and to move that money instead to the Department of Construction and Inspections to spend on legal representation for tenants facing eviction. The budget currently appropriates only $64,522 for that purpose. So Wan's proposal would increase that amount to $534,522. So those are her main proposals that she's added into the budget.
I think the city
wants
can,
to add to the
I
budget.
I think the city can get along just fine without another series of focus groups.
Yeah. And other council members also proposed some monetary changes as well. O'Brien would cut $300,000 of the Uber Lyft rideshare tax from the budget reserves, allocated for the budget reserves, and spend it instead on implementation of the transportation equity agenda, which involves transportation improvements for the south end of the city, which has been largely neglected, I think. Tim O'Brien would
anybody who's tried to take a number 7 bus down to Rainier Beach knows how neglected it's been.
Yeah. Now, Tim O'Brien would also cut $67,000 from the Office of Housing's operating fund and spend it instead on homebuyer counseling, helping people who are home buyers to avoid, for example, adjustable rate mortgages or other unfair terms.
I thought they stopped doing all that after the recession.
No. Now, Teresa Mosqueda would cut $100,000 from Durkin's high barrier probation pilot program and $100,000 from the reserve fund, and she would spend that $200,000 on the Office of Labor Standards Community Outreach and Education Fund, another part of the budget that really needs some attention, because the city council has passed a whole lot of new labor standards in the city of Seattle. It can be difficult for both small business owners and for employees to know what their rights are.
Yeah, and I don't know if there are any numbers yet on how the city has been enforcing all those new laws, but the money for enforcement has simply not been there.
Yeah. Lisa Herbold would cut the sweetened beverage tax amount spent on capital projects for pea patches from $3 million down to $725,000 and spend the freed up $2,275,000 on other priorities identified by the Sweetened Beverage Tax Community Advisory Board. And she lists 7 different projects, from micro grants to food banks and meal programs to programs that facilitate connecting families with child care providers. There's just a lot of other priorities that the advisory board for the sweetened beverage tax had recommended that are not being funded under Mayor Durkin's and Sally Bagshaw's proposed balanced budget.
Those budgets seem to have a running theme of If you're going to spend money on poor people or people who need public assistance, let's not do that.
Yeah, well, in this case, they just said, let's all just give it to the pea patches. Let's just all just throw it in one bucket. And Herbold's saying, well, yeah, let's give some of it to the pea patches, but let's allocate a good chunk of it to some of these other priorities as well.
Sure.
Really just kind of looking at what were the recommendations.
Yeah.
What should this money be used for?
And my sense is that Herbold and Mosqueda's proposals are the ones that are most likely to stick.
Yeah, and I just don't know whether Bagshaw will even consider any of Sawant's proposals, even though some of them are quite good. Now, Bagshaw will take all of these proposals. She'll meet individually with the council members and make changes to her draft budget that she thinks are reasonable. She'll release those changes this coming Monday, and the council will take public testimony at its Monday general meeting at 2 p.m. from public members who want to make comments on the proposed budget. Then the council will vote on each proposed change at Tuesday's 9:30 a.m. budget committee meeting. So they're gonna announce it on Monday at 2 p.m. on Monday. The public can come and testify, and then the next day at 9:30 in the morning, they're gonna start voting on the changes to the budget.
So you've got like a couple of hours to actually absorb the changes that Bagshaw makes and comment on them.
Yeah,
that's a great process.
I know. Then the Monday after next, the council members will vote on the final package. The good part of it is that you can now see city council meetings via live stream on the internet. If you go to the city council webpage and click on the committees, get the committee agendas, and you can see the minutes. You can see the minutes via live stream video. Mm-hmm. You can look at what's on the agenda for upcoming meetings and so forth. So as long as you have an internet connection and you're fairly internet savvy.
And you know where to look.
Which still pretty much restricts a lot of people.
It does restrict a lot of people. So, that's true.
But it's more accessible than it would otherwise be.
It used to be.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Very true. But still doesn't beat going down to City Hall and actually watching and participating in sausage getting made.
Yeah, and that's where I find it kind of interesting that Shama Sawant gets a lot of criticism for holding evening city council committee meetings where other members of the city council just don't bother to show up, but a lot of the public are able to show up because it's not during work hours.
Right.
Yeah.
So people have today and tomorrow pretty much to play catch up and look into the details on this. And then Monday is...
I recommend if you have one particular proposal or maybe two that you really support to go down to Monday's 2 p.m. meeting and just talk about it. Whether or not it's
testify.
In the budget or not, just say, I support this change I want you to vote for it. Just be very respectful, be very brief, but just...
Yeah.
Identify those things that are important to you.
You don't have to be a policy wonk, mm-hmm. But you can say, these are the needs in the community, these are the priorities, and you need to fund this.
Even if you just feel like, why are we still throwing money at the navigation team when we need to fund these tiny home shelters? Because they work, and they work well, and we know that. So why aren't we putting more money to those? Just find one issue that really matters mm-hmm. to you that you think is really important and go talk about that.
Absolutely.
And if nothing else, you'll be able to later if they...
If you can get the time off work.
They go against your wishes, you'll be able to say, literally, I told you so.
Yeah. And, even if you can't take time off work or you can't go and talk about it, there's always email. You can email your city council member.
Or phone them.
Or your district. You can phone them, yeah.
That's very old school.
You can phone your council district rep. You can phone the two at-large reps, Lorena Gonzalez and Teresa Mosqueda. In fact, you can phone all of them if you want.
Because I would phone Bagshaw's office too.
Because the budget is voted on by all the city council members, and they're all supposed to, in the budget negotiations, represent the entirety of the city. So just go ahead and call them all or email them all.
And it's good practice for the next coming 4 years.
Yeah.
Yep.
So.
All right, moving on to the state and the Supreme Court.
The state Supreme Court upheld one of Seattle's key tenant protection laws in a unanimous vote. The state Supreme Court upheld the first-in-time law, which the city council approved in 2016. That law requires landlords to accept the first qualified candidate to apply for a vacant apartment. The first-in-time law was meant to eliminate the effect of discrimination in housing, sex, racial, gender.
An employer. There were a lot of that was passed in direct response to a lot of landlords saying, well, we really want Amazon workers in this building, or, you know, pick a company or pick a handful of companies. And those are acceptable, but nobody else is.
Yeah, or we don't want to rent to somebody who's on a fixed income or who has to rely on assistance as part of their rent, that sort of thing. That can be viewed as discriminatory. Judge Mary Yu on the state Supreme Court pointed out that the first-in-time law is in line with best practices as recommended by the real estate industry, and that she could see no way in which it violates the state constitution. The lawsuit was brought by the conservative Pacific Legal Foundation, which was trying to argue that the law is an illegal taking of private property and that it infringed on landlords' free speech rights.
Oh, my God. I'm in the 90s again.
Yeah.
Takings.
Takings, yeah. The court ruled against both arguments, and in doing so, they voided several previous rulings. The court said that it doesn't have a definition in it. Its own separate definition of what constitutes an illegal taking of property, that therefore they were going to rely on the federal definition of taking of property. And so therefore this case and all future cases will rely on that definition of illegal property seizure. In federal law, that's defined as an actual physical seizing of property or any law that would deprive the owner of, quote unquote, all beneficial use of the property. Now, under that standard, the first-in-time law is not an illegal taking of private property. It also doesn't impinge on the landlord's right to say whatever they want about their rental units or to freely advertise their units for rent. So it's not a violation of landlords' free speech rights.
Yeah, as with campaigns, political campaigns, landlords are free to lie about their about the units.
Or misrepresent them, yeah.
Yes.
Cozy versus the size
Cramped.
Of a closet.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, the ruling to use the federal definition of illegal taking of private property is a really big positive step. Not only does it void a whole bunch of earlier rulings by the state Supreme Court, it also sets a really good precedent for future laws related to regulating private property in the state of Washington. But I think it also shows that this court is amenable to overturning past precedent of previous Supreme Courts in the state of Washington. And that's a really, really good sign for the upcoming lawsuit for Seattle's capital gains
yes.
income tax, as well as efforts to pass a state or other local income tax. The state Supreme Court may also overturn its past ruling that income is a form of property and look instead to how other states have levied income taxes in the United States. I think that is a good, I think this is a good glimmer of hope for folks who are hoping for a more progressive tax structure in the state of Washington.
Absolutely.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Let's move on to national and this week's impeachment news.
Oh, nothing really went on in D.C. this week. We had the first public impeachment hearings this week, and they were spectacular. They also had each of the three witnesses that we heard from this week, William Taylor, George Kent, and Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch, all of them testified to information that was not previously public. And the picture that they have collectively painted of Donald Trump's active involvement in the active conspiracy to extort the government of the Ukraine for Donald Trump's private benefit, that is to say, to try and benefit his 2020 reelection, it's pretty compelling. And I was most amused to see House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff give Ambassador Yovanovitch a chance to respond in real time to Donald Trump's hate tweeting during the impeachment hearings. And he with the quote, "We take witness intimidation very, very seriously." And that may be a separate article of impeachment. Certainly, a lot of Democrats are suggesting that right now. Donald Trump simply can't help himself. He keeps violating his oath of office and keeps violating the law. And it sounds like the Democrats in the House are at least going to try to make him accountable for it. We'll see what happens in the Senate. Next week, there will be several witnesses starting on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday.
Can you talk a little bit about David Holmes, too?
Yes, I'm
okay.
going to get to that.
Great.
Because he may be added next week.
Oh, awesome.
He took a deposition yesterday. We'll talk about David Holmes in a second. We also have Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman who's a key part of this, who will be testifying publicly. And EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland has said he's going to show up on Wednesday. We'll see if he does after the testimony from the new testimony from David Holmes, who is a staffer of William Taylor's in the embassy in Kiev. And
he's a lead political staffer on Ukraine.
Yes, and he was mentioned, although not by name, on Tuesday's hearing by Ambassador Taylor, because Vindman had overheard a conversation in which, after meeting with Ukraine,
you mean Holmes had overheard.
Yes, Holmes had overheard a conversation that EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland had with Donald Trump after meeting with high-level Ukrainian officials the day after Trump's infamous July 25th phone call. So this was July 26th. And so Gordon Sondland is, you know, everybody could hear Donald Trump. In fact, according to Holmes' testimony yesterday, Sondland actually was holding the phone out from his ear because Trump was so loud on the cell phone. And this, mind you, is on a patio in a public restaurant in Kiev, which is, you know, if you want to, if you don't want to call the Russian embassy directly, that's probably the next best thing is to do that. but it underscores once again that Trump has very, very poor security practices for his phone calls. And he has been briefed on that repeatedly and continues to fail to do it because he just can't be bothered, basically. He doesn't care. So that that also is, you know, just another example of he's really over in his head in the presidency. But Sondland was asked repeatedly by Trump, you know, well, are they going to do the investigation? Are they going to do the investigation? And in talking with the Ukrainian official afterwards, who asked Sondland what Sondland thought of Ukraine, and Sondland's reply, and I'm paraphrasing here, it was something like, well, he doesn't really care about the Ukraine. What he cares about is the Bidens.
What he said, I think, was he doesn't care. Well, he said, I think Sondland said to Holmes, he said, when Holmes asked him, he said, Trump only cares about the big stuff.
And, yes, that's right.
And Holmes said, well, you know, Ukraine is in a war with Russia. That's kind
a
of
hot
big,
war.
Big
yeah.
stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And Sondland said, no, Trump only cares about the investigation against the Bidens. And he specifically said the Bidens.
Well, he said that. But mm-hmm. he also said when he was asked about the big, what do you mean by big stuff, he only cares about the things that affect him.
Yeah, that affect him.
And that really underscores his abuse of power, and that's why he's getting
impeached. And this is after Sondland had denied that he knew the Bidens were part of this whole investigation thing that Trump was demanding. So there's a witness who's testifying to the fact that Sondland may have lied to House investigators, and that puts him in the same league as Roger Stone.
Which we'll get to in a minute.
Yeah.
But Sondland is supposed to testify next Wednesday. You can be sure that he's going to be asked about that.
He'll probably be changing his original testimony.
Again.
Yeah.
he may be looking for a new job soon, because I have a hunch he's the next one under the bus.
Yeah. Now, what I found interesting about Yovanovitch's testimony and the response to it was that here it was really clear, and the Democrats were really skillful at drawing her out on this. It was clear that the Trump administration, and Donald Trump in particular, did not care about foreign policy goals in Ukraine. And they were willing to throw that under the bus in order to pursue this right-wing conspiracy theory that has no foundation.
Two right-wing conspiracies.
That could potentially benefit Donald Trump personally. And I found that to be an amazing way to put it all into perspective. The Republicans were fighting with the Democrats on the committee, saying, you know, why is Yovanovitch even here? You know, what can she contribute to this? She was the ambassador to the Ukraine. You know, she was there specifically to show that Trump did not give a crap, as Sondland had said, did not give a crap for U.S. foreign policy goals in Ukraine. And she did a really good job of it.
Yes. And she also underscored that the real beneficiary of this, as with everything in the Trump administration, was Russia. Mm-hmm. And you can be sure that Russia is paying attention to those phone calls. And they knew long before the American public knew what the Trump administration was up to. and that it was actively trying to undercut the government of Ukraine in its war against Russia. Vladimir Putin is the big winner out of all this,
yeah,
and as he always is.
You can imagine him just kind of rubbing his hands and laughing and saying, wow, it's just turning out the way better than I expected.
Yeah. Although I don't think it's going to be as favorable in the next administration.
No.
So they have to get their checklist of to-do items for Donald Trump finished as soon as they can. But so David Holmes is likely to be called as a public witness. He did fly back from Kiev on pretty much 24 hours notice.
And who else is scheduled to testify next week?
Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. Mm-hmm. And also Gordon Sondland.
And
several other people as well. But those are Fiona Hill is another one that's going to be important. Yeah. But so those are the big ones.
Okay.
And they're also doing another deposition today, which is a rare Saturday meeting for a House committee, the person from OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, who signed off on withholding the military aid to the Ukraine because they're trying to trace where did that order come from. And
so that could potentially reveal some explosive stuff as well.
Yes. And again, that's a closed door deposition. But I'm sure that we'll find out about its content if it is that revelatory, or they'll call him as a public witness as well.
All right. You mentioned Roger Stone.
Yeah. Roger Stone is not going to face a really comfortable time in his old age. He was convicted yesterday on 7 felony counts. All 7 felony counts that he was facing, most important of which was witness tampering, which Adam Schiff mentioned in real time. That was about an hour before the Stone verdict came in, as if to underscore the point. So the witness tampering could get him up to 20 years in prison. We'll see what the sentences are, because that's the next stage of this. And he was also convicted of the various counts, basically that he lied to congressional investigators about denying any kind of a role as a go-between with WikiLeaks. So this puts in the public record, basically, and says that a jury agrees with this, that Roger Stone was an active go-between between WikiLeaks and the Trump campaign in 2016. So there was collusion. How about that? The part of this that we didn't know before was because the Mueller investigation, for all its exhaustive 2 years of fact-finding, was never able to talk to some of these people that they got as witnesses. They had David Gates as a witness. They had Steve Bannon as a witness for the prosecution. So it doesn't look good for Roger Stone right now.
All right.
He will be missed. Not really.
And also this week, in response to some of this, the White House released another transcript, or what, a partial transcript?
I would expect it's a partial transcript. It was a transcript of the first phone call that Trump placed to the newly elected leader of Ukraine, Zelensky.
In April,
when he was first elected. And Trump released this in the morning of the congressional hearings yesterday, as if to say, I didn't do anything illegal on that phone call, so it must all be okay. That kind of backfired on him, because somebody, enterprising reporter, went back and looked at the official White House summary of that call that was released in April, and it doesn't match at all. So somebody's lying somewhere.
Yeah, and the way that the Trump White House explained that was that they said the call had been summarized by some low-level person before it had actually taken place, which does not seem to me to be a credible explanation.
You know, the Trump White House is so chaotic that it's just possible.
It's possible.
But, yeah, it's certainly not best practice, put it that way.
Yeah, and then they said, oh, and then later when the call took place, Trump didn't actually do what they said on what the summary said, what he was supposed to say. Didn't say any of that. He just kind of flew on his own, under his own.
He didn't say any of the stuff about being a good partner in the fight against corruption, for example.
Yeah, he didn't say any of that stuff. And then no staffer updated the summary of the call afterwards, and I find that to be not a very good explanation.
Implausible.
Yeah, pretty implausible.
All right. Also, this week it appears the water surrounding Stephen Miller is getting warmer.
Yes, it is. The proverbial frog boiling, as it were. Southern Poverty Law Center's blog Hate Watch dug up a bunch of old emails from Miller when he was actively pitching ideas in 2014, 2015 to Breitbart News. which of course was run at that point by Steve Bannon. These people all know each other, and the emails themselves came from an editor there who has since had a change of heart about her previous standing in the anti-immigration movement. But at the time, she was a true believer, and so Miller would keep pitching her on stories, and they were often stories picked up from far-right white nationalist websites. A lot of ugly stuff, honestly. And he was pretty obsessed with crime committed by immigrants. He was obsessed with immigrants in general being a bad idea. And the association with white nationalist websites has resulted in a lot of Democrats calling on him to resign, which of course is probably a badge of honor within the Trump White House. So I doubt he's going to resign, but it does show you what should have been obvious from his policy priorities over the last 3 years, that he has very strong white nationalist leanings.
All right.
At best.
Mm-hmm. Okay, moving on. Maria?
I want to talk a little bit about the New York Times and the two progressive Democratic presidential candidates, Sanders and Warren. This week was a week in which Michael Bloomberg, a former mayor of New York and another unnecessary billionaire, tried to jump into the race for the Democratic presidential campaign. In addition, former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick made a last-minute jump into the race. Both of these candidates are seen as moderate Democrats who would replace Joe Biden's stumbling campaign. And so I think we have to ask ourselves, you know, why all the panic and rush on the part of the Democratic Party leadership to try to find somebody who's a moderate Democrat to wipe away Sanders and Warren.
And the donor class.
Yeah. And why are we seeing, you know, Microsoft mogul Bill Gates snuggling up to the media to trash talk the wealth tax, you know, on billionaires? And I think the mainstream media has made has played a really big role in causing this panic, as illustrated by Friday's edition of the New York Times. Now, I see this.
Oh, yeah.
I see this at least two or three times a week. Multiple articles in one edition of New York Times that just trash Warren and Sanders. But I'm just going to take Friday's edition of the New York Times as an example. It contained two articles. First, in the national section, was a prominent article entitled, quote, "Sanders climate ambitions thrill supporters, experts aren't impressed," end quote, by Lisa Friedman with help from Sydney Ember. So I asked myself, which experts did they talk to about Bernie Sanders' climate change policy, right? Well, David Victor, he's professor of international relations at UC San Diego. Victor is not a climate scientist, he's not an economist, and he's a climate advisor to rival candidate Pete Buttigieg, who's one of the most conservative candidates in the Democratic campaign race. He was number one expert in the article. Number two, Jesse Jenkins, energy systems engineer and assistant professor at Princeton University. Jenkins is a professor in the Department of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering at Princeton, and his curriculum vitae says, quote, "Jesse's research focuses on improving and applying optimization-based energy systems models to evaluate low-carbon energy technologies, policy options, and robust decisions under deep uncertainty," end quote. And what that gobbledygook all means is that his papers are mostly critical of policy proposals to transition to low carbon technologies. The New York Times article.
In other words, he's trying to promote that uncertainty.
Yeah, the New York Times article cites Jenkins after a paragraph in which they say unnamed quote unquote economists say that Sanders' plan is unworkable. Jenkins, however, is not an economist, not even close. Paul Hawkins is the third expert. He's a noted environmentalist, and he's author of Project Drawdown. He is quoted as saying, quote, Sanders' sense of urgency in here is correct, in my opinion, but you can take that sense of urgency and make it more effective, end quote. Unfortunately, the New York Times article doesn't ask Hawkins what he means by more effective. In Sanders, you know, they don't ask, is Sanders' plan not radical enough, maybe? Maybe that's why it's not effective. It doesn't go quite far
maybe
enough.
That's why they cut off the quote.
Yeah, maybe that's why they cut off the quote. Yeah. So apparently the New York Times was satisfied with just printing something that sounded like criticism, not delving into what Hawken actually meant. The fourth expert is Joel Payne. He's a Democratic strategist and PR person who worked in the Hillary Clinton campaign. Payne has also worked for PR firm Corvus as the leading public relations specialist for the American Chemistry Council. That's an industry group that represents the interests of major corporations like BASF, Bayer, Chevron, DuPont, ExxonMobil, Honeywell, Dow, Phillips, Occidental Petroleum, et cetera. So what an expert there. The fifth expert that they cite is Severin Borenstein. He's a professor of the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley, who, according to his curriculum vitae, specializes in, quote, business competition, strategy, and regulation, end quote, especially in the oil and gas industries and the electricity markets. He's been involved with California's emissions market and cap and trade policies. But what does Borenstein actually say in the New York Times article? He expresses a very reasonable doubt that Sanders will see will have problems getting Congress to implement his policies. Borenstein, however, doesn't criticize those particular policies in the New York Times article. The New York Times article goes on to say that, quote, not everyone sees doom in Mr. Sanders' nationalization of the power sector, end quote. Then they quote positive comments from two folks, Noah Kaufman, who they call a researcher at Columbia University, and who is actually, when you look online, is actually a real economist, one of the only real economists that they cite in the article, and he's a scholar at the Columbia Center on Global Energy Policy. He also sat on Barack Obama's White House Council on Environmental Quality. He says, quote, that Sanders' plan recognized that the planet could not afford to wait for market forces to find solutions. His direct quote, climate change presents risks that are big and that are scary, and for that reason it's being talked about like a crisis. He's proposing policies that match that rhetoric, end quote. That's the quote from the only economist in the article. And the second expert they quote is Michael Oppenheimer, who the New York Times lists in the article only as, quote, professor of geoscience and international affairs at Princeton, end quote. But Oppenheimer served for many years as the chief scientist at the Environmental Defense Fund, and he is a longtime leading participant in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and he has been the lead author of some of their biggest reports. He expresses disappointment that Bernie Sanders no longer supports a carbon tax, but he says that, quote, Sanders wins points on vision, end quote. Another quote from that article is, when I talk about these issues, I have to be realistic, but that's why I don't run for president. You need more than that in the political arena, end quote. And that's hardly a criticism. Unfortunately, both of those real experts are quoted at the very end of the article. And
we're about 5% of people have read through.
Yeah, most readers won't get that far or know how to evaluate the experts that come before them. Now, the second article is entitled War and Wealth Tax Could Slow Economy, Early Analysis Finds, by Jim Tankersley. This article is even more transparently biased. It starts out, Senator Elizabeth Warren's proposed wealth tax would slow the United States economy, reducing growth by nearly 0.2 percentage points a year over the course of a decade, an outsider analysis of the plan estimates. That sounds like an assertion of fact, right? But the New York Times qualifies it by calling it an outsider analysis. But then you have to ask, what does that mean? The analysis was done by the Penn Wharton Budget Model, a project of the Penn Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. It's a tool that anyone can use to evaluate different policy proposals, but the results of the model depend heavily on what you put into it, what the inputs are. In this case, the outcome, a tiny reduction in economic growth, was produced by entering only the wealth tax increase and then applying the tax revenue collected from that to only pay down the federal deficit, not to spend it on the various spending plans that Elizabeth Warren has earmarked the tax increase for, things like universal child care, education funding, student loan forgiveness, et cetera.
And I would bet they didn't factor green job growth into that either.
No, they did not. That makes the analysis useless as a real-world projection. And this really reveals the inherent bias of some economists who decide, well, I'm going to make the analysis easy by putting in one kind of input and one or two kinds of input and getting a result. And the New York Times, instead of acknowledging that this is a first draft of an analysis, which is not even published yet, on the Penn Wharton budget models website.
So it hasn't been peer-reviewed at all?
No, has not been peer-reviewed at all. Taking that and writing up a major article and printing it prominently in the business section of their newspaper.
All right. Events.
We got a few coming up today. Joe Biden is in town. He's looking for money for his cash trap campaign. He recently announced he's going to take money from corporations, which doesn't seem like much of a change, honestly. But this is the fourth time he's been to Washington State, and each time it's been to raise money, not for a public appearance. His fundraising dinner tonight, $2,800 a plate. I'm sure there's seats available. Will be in Upper Queen Anne. And so there will be a protest outside the site. Block Amazon's bid on Biden because the hosts of the dinner are high-level Amazon executives. Since they probably decided they couldn't buy city council, they buy something easier, a presidency or something. I don't get it. That protest will be from 4:30 to 6 o'clock tonight at Cary Park. That's at 2nd and Highland on Upper Queen Anne. So if you're in that area, do stop by, lend your voice to all that. Also tonight, Shama Sawant is throwing a victory party and concert. There will be music, comedy, and red signs, lots of red signs. That'll be at Washington Hall in the Central District at 4143 14th Avenue. It's just north of Yesor.
All right. So we won't see you next week. We might not see you for a couple weeks because you're going in for surgery.
I am, but I will be back eventually.
All right.
And I'm sure nothing will happen while I'm gone, so it's safe.
Yeah.
I will try to do my best to keep up with the impeachment proceedings.
Good luck with that.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I speak for nearly everyone listening that we're all keeping our fingers crossed that you'll be back sooner rather than later.
And that your surgery will go well.
Yes. That's my goal as well. Thank you.
All right. Mm-hmm. And a happy birthday to you both.
Just oh, yeah.
Oh, thank you. Yes, we're both November babies.
Yep. We are not twins. I want to dispel that rumor before it starts, but we do have birthdays very close to each other.
Yeah.
And they were both this week.